But after an introduction like that, a speaker has no place to go except down. But I thank you very much, Mr. Steele, and it is a great pleasure to be here. And I might say, I thought yesterday when I was listening to the singing, and no place in the world do people sing like Scotsmen. And as I looked out the window at those beautiful hills, I really felt transported, as Paul once described it, into the next world and into heaven. And I thought, no place would I rather be right at this moment. And so I go back to the ME Foundation, I can tell you right now, telling them how enthusiastic I am for CREEF and for this conference and for the wonderful brotherhood that we've experienced when we've been here just these last 2 days. It's always a little intimidating, you know, when there are several speakers in a conference like this, one after another. And I can't help but think of a true story that affects someone that involves someone that I know all of you would know, or at least know the name, of a generation of ago, two great preachers by the name of Harold Akengay and Donald Barnhouse. And at a particular time in America, Barnhouse and Akengay went on a preaching tour together and went from city to city. And they would take turns. They would every night arrive at a different church, and one would speak first one night, and then the next night the other would speak first. Through the entire 30 days, Akengay used a different speech every night. Barnhouse gave exactly the same message. Akengay, of course, had to sit there and listen to the same message. My wife knows exactly how that feels. Akengay had an extraordinary mind. And to keep himself amused and entertained while Barnhouse was preaching, brilliantly, I might say, while Barnhouse was preaching, Akengay sat there memorizing Barnhouse's sermon. The last night they arrived in Richmond, Virginia, in a Presbyterian church, First Presbyterian Church of Richmond, and as fate would have it, Akengay went first. Great sense of humor in a droll way. He couldn't resist the opportunity, and he stood up and word for word gave Barnhouse a sermon. All the while looking over at Barnhouse and getting absolutely no response from Barnhouse at all, who sat there absolutely impassively, got up, and of course, being the great preacher that he was, gave an entirely new sermon and gave it brilliantly. Never said a word to Akengay. Akengay couldn't stand it. Walking out of the church that night, Akengay finally could contain himself no longer, and he said, "Donald, they seem to enjoy your sermon here tonight." Barnhouse said, "Yes, but not nearly so much as they did when I preached it here 3 months ago." Ever since, I've always liked to preach first. When Mr. Still wrote to me about coming to CREEF, he gave me the requirements for the conference. And the loving spirit among the brethren, which I have certainly experienced. And he also said that all participants were expected to adhere to the Westminster Confession. And so before I begin, I should make something of a confession myself. I took the Westminster Confession, which I had not read for a while, and went through it chapter by chapter and came agreeing with every word until chapter 28. I confess I'm a Baptist. I read that part, elegantly put, about dipping is not necessary, and I agree with that. I have no disagreement with that. I can understand exactly why that is so. It is simply the outward manifestation of an inward regeneration. I just don't understand why you Presbyterians feel you want to take a chance. But I certainly am here as a five-point Calvinist, and no one could be in politics as long as I was without being thoroughly convinced of the total depravity of man. Was it Chesterton who once said that the depravity of man, the doctrine of the depravity of man, was the only philosophy empirically validated by 3,500 years of human history. And we certainly see the evidence of that, do we not? I've chosen today not to give an expository message because I'd be intimidated to do so in the presence of so many great preachers, but rather to do what I believe is my calling as a layman who has been much of my life in the world and now the last 15 years of my life in Christian service, and that is to attempt to look at the Christian faith today and its relationship to the world. I will make a few propositions today, three of them to be precise, and to give you the evidence that I see in support of those propositions, which I think when taken as a whole dictate particularly to those of us in the Reformed tradition what the responsibility and duty and calling of the church in its broadest sense ought to be with respect to the world we live in. The first of the three propositions is that we are living in a time in Western culture in which society, contrary to its traditions and historic development, has become almost, and I use that word advisedly, almost wholly secularized. Now, that word is not often understood, but a secularist, according to Webster's definition, is one who rejects every form of religious faith and worship and undertakes to live accordingly, one who believes that education and other civil matters should be without religious element. The second proposition which I will advance today is that a free society as we know it cannot exist as a secularized society. That is, that a vital religious faith is absolutely essential for the preservation of a free society. And third, that the Christian who serves a sovereign God has a duty toward the world that God created, towards God's creation. And the church is the one institution in society, historically and certainly the case today, which is capable of the kind of moral education that could take a secularized society and restore to that secularized society a set of values. I caution at the outset that I'm speaking from an American perspective. Although I travel around the world and spend a great deal of time in other cultures, I'm influenced, of course, by what I see primarily happening in America, although I think what is happening in America is, to varying degrees, also happening around the world, and certainly the attitudes of cultural elites in Western civilization are following a similar line. It's one of the great ironies of our time, isn't it, that the West, which has enjoyed a rich, rich Christian heritage, Judeo-Christian influence has been so vital in the formation of Western values, that the West is becoming secularized as the East is experiencing an enormous spiritual movement toppling governments. Amazing. After 70 years of atheism, born in the churches, a movement is now overthrowing governments in the East while the West is rejecting its traditional, historical, Judeo-Christian values. This was, interestingly enough, pointed out by Alexander Solzhenitsyn in what I regard as one of the most prophetic speeches of the second half of the 20th century when he addressed the Harvard University commencement class in 1978, and he said, there's going to be a great spiritual awakening in the world, but it won't be in the West. It'll be in the East. The West is suffering from a loss of moral courage and resolve, while the Spirit of God still lives in the people of my homeland, Russia. And the West is experiencing spiritual exhaustion. Western media suddenly found themselves disinterested in talking much further with Solzhenitsyn after that speech. But it's certainly been prophetic when you read that speech now in the context of current events. I thought it was an amazing evidence of the sovereignty of God and the timing of the talk this morning about relativity and Einstein's theories of relativity, and the central theme of what I think has brought about the secularization of the West, which is relativism. And sadly, those two terms are often confused. In 1919, when Einstein brought forth his theory of relativity, I think a lot of people confused relativity in terms of space and time with relativity in terms of ideas. Paul Johnson, the eminent British historian, writes that that was a certain turning point in the history of the 20th century. We began to confuse relativity with relativism. Relativism has become the prevailing way of thought in Western life today. Alan Bloom, an American professor, wrote a book 3 years ago entitled The Closing of the American Mind, and he wrote this in the opening paragraph. He said, "There is one thing a college professor can be absolutely certain of. Almost every student entering the university believes, or says he believes, that truth is relative." Now, in a society in which truth is relative, in which relativism is the prevailing ethos of that society, it inevitably must secularize. And this is something that I'm afraid Christian thinkers have lost sight of. It is an inescapable conclusion, consequence, that there must be a secularizing of a society in which truth is no longer held to be absolute. Why? Because we who believe that truth is revealed propositional truth from God cannot be accepted in a relativistic society. You and I are looked at as bigots in Western society today because we hold to the view that there is absolute truth. And the prevailing view in every area of cultural leadership in the Western society today is that truth is whatever you find it to be. Truth is whatever you find it to be. No longer is it absolute. And it's interesting how this begins to play itself out in society. I watched a television program in America recently when we had a Supreme Court of the United States decided that the state of Louisiana, one of the 50 states in the United States, which had passed a statute saying that creationism could be taught as an acceptable alternative theory to evolution, could be taught as a matter of academic freedom in the schools. The Supreme Court of the United States ruled 5-4, a split decision, very close, that violated the separation of church and state, a problem we have in the United States that you do not have here in British Isles. But in any event, they struck down this statute, which was passed in the interest of academic freedom to allow creationism to be taught. I watched one of our leading newsmen, one of the three leading anchormen that night, interviewing the attorney who argued that case for the state of Louisiana. And this man, who is what C.S. Lewis would be the epitome of what C.S. Lewis described when he talked about the new barbarians. He said, the new barbarians aren't people who come in leopard skins, the Goths and Vandals with their clubs. They are the nice people with the clean fingernails and the blue pinstripe suits who meet in the comfort of boardrooms. And this particular broadcaster, whom I know well, and used to interview me when I was in politics a lot, took this young lawyer to task, and he started asking all these questions, just the questions you would expect to be asked. And this young lawyer was absolutely brilliant. I was astonished. I was watching. It was by a remote. They weren't in the same room, but it was by remote distance, by a camera. And he kept leaning into the monitor where you could see this lawyer's face, asking these questions, getting more and more frustrated. And finally, when he couldn't penetrate, when he couldn't make any points with this lawyer, he finally leaned into the monitor and he said, "But weren't these people who passed this law in the legislature, weren't they religious people?" As if that would disqualify them. I wrote an article about that, saying that because a person is a religious person, is he therefore disqualified from public debate in the eyes of the cultural elite in America? A pastor read that article, sent it to Tom Brokaw, and Brokaw wrote a letter back to him saying, "My question was an attempt to demonstrate." Remember when questions were an attempt to elicit information? "My question was an attempt." "My question was an attempt to demonstrate that the sponsors of this legislation were specifically attempting to impose their religious values on all the school children of Louisiana, and that is a corruption of the Constitution." Angry letter. Why? Because they were religious people, advancing it for a wholly secular purpose, but nonetheless religious leaders. The reasoning carried to its logical conclusion would say that a Christian, because he believed in the Ten Commandments, would no longer be able to vote on legislation holding murder to be illegal. And this is why religious values simply are being stripped out of culture and the political sense. Same thing is happening in the media. I can't tell you the number of interviews that I've done in the media in which, just before going on the air, as a matter of fact, one night on BBC, there was a late night program that came on at 10 o'clock at night, I think, an interview program. And I'll never forget the interviewer just before in London, but just before I was to go on, saying to me, and this happens all the time, saying, "Now, Mr. Colson, we want to talk about prisons and former President Nixon and your experiences in politics, but we don't know," and then they begin to stumble around not knowing exactly how to put it, but "this is not a religious program, you know." And I'd say, "Well, I'm not going to talk about religion. I never talk about religion. I do talk about how Jesus Christ has changed my life," and did that night on BBC, to the interviewer's horror. "But you'd be amazed how often I'm told quite explicitly before going on a program not to talk about religion or this born-again thing or this so-called experience you've had," and they can't quite get the words out. It's happening across the board in education in the United States, and I suspect from some of the conversations we've had around the table that the same things are happening here in Scotland and in Great Britain. Stanford University, one of our finest universities in America, you've all heard of Stanford. Just about a year ago, all of the students went out and assembled on the campus protesting the classics courses in which they are taught to read the great books of Western civilization. They rallied behind one of our political figures, a man by the name of Jesse Jackson, and they paraded across the campus chanting, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, Western civilization's got to go." Now, I don't know where it's going to go, but they wanted to get rid of Western civilization. Their objection was that all of the writers of the great books of Western civilization were white males. As someone mused in a column, "If only Plato had been a lesbian Comanche." But the Stanford faculty obligingly changed the curriculum to include other than what have historically been regarded as the authors of the great works of Western civilization. Russell Kirk, one of our great social critics in America, did a study of textbooks in our schools, and he found one that I think is a classic. It is written in this textbook, quote, "In the Middle Ages, there was a religion called Christianity, which caused the building of many churches." Same thing is happening in business. Amazing experience in America in business recently, and this is so indicative of what is happening throughout the fabric of Western society. A friend of mine who's been very, very successful in business and in government gave $30 million to Harvard, to the business school at Harvard, to endow a chair in ethics because we've had so many ethical scandals in business and in the investment industry that this man who had been the head of the Securities Commission in America gave much of his fortune to Harvard and said, set up a chair in ethics. He gave this money to them 2.5 years ago. What do you suppose has happened? Nothing. There's a 1 3-week teaching module at Harvard Business School today, 1 3-week teaching course on ethics. And what it basically teaches is that it's bad business to be a high roller. Do you use that phrase here in Scotland? Bad business to take too many chances. Utilitarian ethics. And I have bombarded Harvard with questions and calls to their public information officer, repeatedly saying, what's happened to the $30 million? And they come back with the most grievous explanations, that they're debating this, they're having discussions in the faculty. The explanation is very simple. How do you have an ethical system if there are no absolutes? Ethics become wholly subjective. And that's the reason that you see, if you read about what's happening in America, a breakdown of character on virtually every front in American life. Two candidates for President of the United States having to withdraw because of character issues. The Speaker of the House of Representatives having to stand down this year because of ethical considerations. A number of congressmen having to leave office because of ethical considerations. An enormous scandal in the housing agency. $200 billion, unthinkable amount of money that has been stolen out of all of our savings and loan housing associations right across the board. And most tragic, religious leaders breaching the most sacred trust of all to proclaim the gospel of Christ and to trade that for personal greed or sexual gratification. But in any society in which absolutes are no longer tolerated, then inevitably there's a breakdown of character because there is no basis for ethics. On what can you construct an ethical system? Morality goes up and down. That simply reflects the mores of the times. The ethics is something that is absolute, and without an absolute system, there's no ethics. We see the same thing happening in government. Laws are enacted, have been enacted recently in 4 major United States cities in which homosexual marriage has now been accepted on equal terms with heterosexual marriage and given the same legal standing. We had funding this past summer of a artist's work. There was much controversy. This artist depicted a crucifix submerged in urine, and Christian groups were up in arms that it was funded by money of the United States government, and an attempt was made to ban that in the Senate of the United States, which attempt was defeated in the name of freedom of artistic expression. There's even a lawsuit going on now in the United States to require the town of Zion, Illinois, to change its name. You see, what happens in a society where it has rejected values sounds very enlightened. That is, tolerance becomes the supreme virtue. That's very enlightened. Until you realize that someone who comes along and says, no, I believe that there is truth, is breaking what is the supreme and cardinal virtue of society, tolerance. And that person becomes a bigot. Also becomes impossible to ever have a resolution of moral debate. Moral debate becomes interminable in a society without a value system. It simply becomes a question of I prefer not to murder. And you do what you prefer not to do. And you can never resolve a moral debate. That's one reason we can never seem to resolve the right to life abortion debate in America. It shifts from month to month, because it becomes a matter simply of preference. 57% of the American people said they thought abortion was murder, but 72% said they would not outlaw it. My belief of what is murder, I simply won't impose on you in a tolerant society. The consequences of this are pernicious because you begin to have a loss of Judeo-Christian influence on the formation of society values. And we see what happens when a society loses its understanding of sin. I was in Norway last year in the prisons, which has become Norway an enlightened post-Christian culture in terms of its values. And they told me when I went through the prison where there were 100 inmates, they said 78% of them are here for mental problems. I said, mental problems? 78%? They said, yes, they committed crimes that were so terrible that they have to be a result of a mental aberration. I said, couldn't they have been committed those crimes because they were sinners? And the psychiatrist I talked to was just horrified that I would think that that person might be accountable for their own actions. It was tragic because I preached in the prison chapel and I had a wonderful experience preaching. And when I got through, this young correctional officer, woman officer, female officer, came up to me and said, Mr. Colson, it was so thrilling to hear someone come here today and preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. And she was a charming, a beautiful woman who looked in her late 20s. And when I left Norway, our friends in the ministry there sent me a clipping. A week later, I received the clipping. It was just 2 days after I'd been there. That beautiful young woman correctional officer had taken a convicted rapist and murderer to a movie in the city because it's the policy of the corrections department. Because people are not sinners, they are mentally ill and disturbed, so they need to be restored to normalcy, and so they're taken to movie theaters. This young woman had taken a convicted rapist murderer to a movie, and he had raped her and bludgeoned her to death and left her at the side of the road. So that's what happens when you take sin out of a society. You begin to distort the sense of individual responsibility and individual accountability. And second consequence of the secularization of society is that you lose entirely the acceptance of the authority of the church. If you really want to know why the church is declining in influence, it is because people no longer believe that the church has any right or claim upon absolute truth. And if there's one thing we need to preach in the church, it's the orthodox confession of truth that we believe. And people are afraid to do it, afraid they'll drive people out of the churches. Well, drive them out. But hang on to that truth, cling to it. 81% of the American people recently surveyed said that they believed they could come to their own religious beliefs without the aid of any church or synagogue. It means we've lost the claim to have authority over people who come into the church. No wonder people want to go to church and make them feel good. I have a neighbor who contributes to our ministry and professes to be a Christian, and so I got her aside one night because she goes to a church called a Unity Church, part of the New Age movement that we heard Howard Taylor talk about this morning. And I said to this woman, I said, finally, I felt emboldened enough to say to her, do you really realize what the church you go to preaches? I said, it doesn't believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the bodily resurrection of Christ. It doesn't believe in the heart of the Christian faith. It's preaching something that God is in you. And I started to go through a description of what the New Age movement does. And she said, and I got all through and I said, you profess to be a Christian that you go to that church. She said, oh yes, but she said, I've never gone there that the pastor hasn't made me feel so good. See, in a secularized society without values, people want to be made to feel good. Just as Paul wrote to Timothy, the time will come when people will want their ears tickled. Well, how has all this happened? I, by the way, I'm doing today what I have spent once 4 hours doing in lectures, and I'm doing it all in 1 hour. And so what I'm doing is speaking very fast, which I do anyway, and with my accent, I know that's going to be difficult for you, but you can get the tape and play it back on slow speed afterwards. I'll do my very best to get through this and keep within my time constraints. How has all this happened? Thank you. How has all this happened? Well, I don't want to go back through a long philosophical discussion this morning, but the point that Howard Taylor was making, the time 2 centuries ago when man concluded from a scientific point of view that the God hypothesis was no longer necessary, when the French encyclopedists decided that you could explain the creation of the earth without God, suddenly you no longer needed God for moral discourse and moral formulation. And the seeds of the Enlightenment were planted 2 centuries ago, aided by a neighbor from Edinburgh, one of the most articulate advocates of the Enlightenment era. David Hume made such a powerful contribution, exalting human reason. Nietzsche, 100 years ago, I think really captured what has been the movement of modern thought. Nietzsche was a brilliant, had brilliant insights into human nature, the will to power. He really correctly understood what makes people what they are. And Nietzsche predicted 100 years ago, he said, the time will come in the 20th century. He didn't argue that there was no God. He was much too smart for that, because the arguments, the cosmological arguments you heard this morning, are far too persuasive. He didn't argue there was no God. What he argued is that men would kill God because they would live as if God doesn't exist. Precisely what we've done. The legacy of the Enlightenment was simply to enable us to live as if God doesn't exist. And Blaise Pascal, 3 centuries earlier, the great French mathematician, great philosopher, wonderful contributions to Western thought. We can forgive him that he is the man who designed the computer originally. Since I can't work a word processor, I can forgive him for that. But he foresaw exactly what a spiritual vacuum would mean when he said, without God, people do 2 things. They either try to be God themselves, or they look for satisfaction through their senses. And you look around at Western civilization today, and I would submit to you, my brothers, that what you see happening is men trying to be God themselves or seeking satisfaction out of their senses. Pascal was absolutely right. And Nietzsche predicted this would happen. It has happened. Pascal said it would happen, and that is precisely what is happening. We have a sociologist in America by the name of Robert Bella. He happens to be a churchgoer, and I think he's got a heart for God, although he's never made what you and I would regard as an evangelical profession, but his name, very brilliant man at the University of California, Robert Bella, said that there were 2 overriding goals. He took 200 average middle-class Americans, and I suspect you'd find the same thing here in Scotland. He took 200 average middle-class Americans. He said, now, we really want to examine what their goals are in life, and he came away with 2 goals, overriding goals, people have for life. 1, vivid personal feeling. 2, personal success. And then he asked them, and this is very interesting to those of you who are pastors especially, he said, what do you expect from the institutions of life? What do you expect from work? And people responded and said, personal advancement. Fair enough. Then he said, what do you expect from marriage? And people said, personal development. No wonder marriages are in trouble. And then he asked what they expect from the church. And they said, personal fulfillment. The second premise that I would advance to you today is that religious values, and I use that term deliberately, religious values, are essential to the well-being of a free society. Religiori, I might advise you the word religion comes from the Latin religiare, which means to bind together. Religion has historically, in through every single society in human history, been the root of its culture. It is that which calls people together. It's that which binds people together. And the crisis of character we see taking place is simply the result of the loss of what has been through Western civilization. Call it natural law, call it Judeo-Christian revelation, call it the accumulated wisdom of 23 centuries of Western civilization. There has been an absolute foundation. Christopher Dawson, the historian, said that the Judeo-Christian truth has been the heart, the soul of Western civilization. Will Durant, the historian, put it another way. He said, there's never been an example in history before our time of a society successfully maintaining a moral life without the aid of religion. Plato, pre-Christian days, understood. Without God, there could be no justice, there could be no concord among people. Without that transcendent value system, there's nothing to bind us together. Now, I don't want to be in politics, and I have been forewarned about using this quote, but let me leave all politics aside, please. I'm out of politics. I have done my time, literally and figuratively. But I was terribly struck by the words used, and I hope I don't offend anyone, by the words used by Margaret Thatcher when she spoke here in the Church of Scotland. Because what she said, whether you agree with her politics or disagree, what she said was profound. When she said that the truths of the Judeo-Christian heritage are infinitely precious, not only because I believe them to be true, this is Margaret Thatcher speaking, but because they provide the moral impulse that calls people to rise above themselves to something greater than themselves. And without that moral impulse, democracy can't survive. Whatever else you like or don't like about Margaret Thatcher, she's right in saying that. That is a profound truth that a secular society rejects at its peril. Now, brothers, let me say, we heard this morning a brilliant apologetic for the existence of God from a cosmological standpoint. I would offer you another apologetic for the existence of God. I would say that as ministers of the gospel of Jesus Christ, we should be doing everything in our power, and certainly Knox and Calvin would approve of this, to argue to secular society the merits of the Judeo-Christian truth being faithfully lived out in our society by telling our secular neighbors that you may not believe what we believe, but common grace, you can't exist without us. And don't say that with arrogance, say it as we heard yesterday so brilliantly by Sinclair Ferguson, to say it with love and humility. But we've got to somehow, as an apologetic, persuade the secular society that, and if they really understood it, they would conclude that they need us. They need the influence of the Judeo-Christian truth in society, because without that, the society which gives them all of their cherished self-indulgent pleasures is doomed. Somehow, as an apologetic, we as thinking Christians have to make that case. What religious values are we talking about? There are really four. I'm hurrying, Mr. Still, because I want time for questions, because I think I probably have stirred the pot at least three times or four. Bound to do it a couple more times before I finish. There are four things that the Judeo-Christian truth means to a society. And one, if I may borrow Mrs. Thatcher's phrase, is the moral impulse. When I spoke just briefly last night, I mentioned William Wilberforce. He's a great hero for my life because he loved God and had a passion for justice. And at the risk of his own political career, as a matter of fact, at the cost of any chance of being prime minister, he fought for 20 years to bring an end to the barbaric practice of bringing black bodies from the holds of ships out of Africa and selling them in the Western Hemisphere. And he prevailed. That's the moral impulse. In the ministry God has called me to, we have 30,000 volunteers in America going into the prisons. The prisons are rotten holes in America, dreadfully overcrowded, violent, dangerous places. And yet 30,000 people are going in to share the love of God with people in those holes. The least lovable people in our society. Why? Not because there's anything attractive or comfortable or glamorous about going to the prisons, but because they are moved, constrained by the love of God to go and share it with those people. That's the moral impulse. And wherever I go, what a witness that is. I tell you, I go on these secular radio and television programs, and they would love to just chew me to pieces because they really don't like what I stand for or say, but they cannot deny the truth of what they see all those volunteers doing. And I go to Chile or Peru, and I see 4,000 prison fellowship volunteers going into the Lurigancho prison, one of the rottenest holes I've ever been anywhere in my life. Around the world, I see the people in Madagascar going in and feeding inmates, keeping 700 inmates alive a week by providing the food from Christian volunteers going into the prisons, inmates who would otherwise starve. That's the moral impulse. And that's provided only by people, the love of God. You can't pass laws to make people do that. You can't redistribute wealth and have funds then going into the prisons to keep starving people hungry. They'd be the people forgotten. That's done as Augustine put it. We should be the best of citizens because we do out of the love of God what others do only because they're forced to by law. That's the moral impulse. We opened up recently an AIDS facility in a prison in Baltimore, Maryland. I went on a hot August afternoon and saw what Christian workers inside that prison had done to renovate a whole wing of the prison where the people dying of AIDS could have a place to live, bookshelves, television set, painted the cell blocks, and we had a great dedication service. We named it the Living Room for the Living Savior. And to stand there and hold hands with those men who have AIDS, who are dying, all the rest of society turned their back. Christian doesn't turn his back. That's the moral impulse. Secondly, crucially important, without the Judeo-Christian truth, and I suppose we could say natural law, but that's based upon Judeo-Christian tradition, there is no consensus. There's nothing that supports a value system in a society. I only got two ways to support law in a society. Excuse me, there's no way to support a rule of law. There's only two ways to support law in a society. You either support it with a moral consensus among the people, or you support it at the point of a bayonet. Chairman Mao, he said, morality begins at the muzzle of a gun. You got two choices. I want to stand up on the rooftops and shout at all my secular friends, all the men that I served in politics with and government, and say, don't you understand? If you secularize society, you are driving out the basis of the moral consensus that supports the rule of law, and you've got to then support it by bayonet. And secondly, that moral consensus provides a civilizing influence. You know, we have a tremendous crisis in the United States today with drugs and crime, and for some reason, which it would be interesting to find out why, the crime rate has declined and the imprisonment rate has declined here in Scotland, but in America it is skyrocketing. And drugs, I know, are a scourge in every culture. And the problem is that in America, at least, and I think this is true here in Great Britain, because we visited with many of your government officials when I was here last spring, and I visited with your commissioner, your superintendent of prisons yesterday, or Monday morning in Edinburgh for breakfast. Drugs are going to continue to be a problem through Western society. And the problem is that everybody is trying to respond to it by building institutions. You can't stop the drug or crime crisis by institutions. You could seal off the borders of every country. You could double and quadruple the prisons in the country. You could hire more judges. You could hire more investigators. You could hire more police. And you wouldn't stop drugs. Case in point, I was in prison for 7 months. I never went to sleep one night in prison without smelling marijuana burning. Fences, guards, watchtowers. If people want drugs, they'll get drugs. The problem is that we have a society which has rejected all of its values, and we are teaching young people that there is no absolute right and wrong. They're not getting taught absolute right and wrong in schools. Unfortunately, too many families are failing to teach their children in the ways of God and right and wrong during those morally formative years of 1 to 6. And then the children sit down in front of the television set, and in America we have this abominable beer commercial which comes on and says, you only go around this way once, so grab for all the gusto while you can. And these kids believe that pleasure is the object of life. And as long as we have a society with no transcendent values, pleasure does become, as Pascal said, the object of life. And if pleasure is the object of life, why not go off and smoke marijuana or sniff cocaine or shoot yourself full of heroin? Only way we are ever going to stop the drug and crime crisis in Western society is to stop not the supply. Yes, do everything you can to stop the supply, of course. Stop the demand. How do you stop the demand? The church gives a moral vision to society that there's something better to live for than simply pleasure. We teach that there is absolute right and wrong. That God has created us with some dignity, that there's a purpose for living. This is what the Christian influence brings to bear in society. It provides the root, the glue for the social contract as well. Not only the moral consensus, not only the civilizing influence, but the social contract. How can there be a social contract if people do not think there is any cause greater than themselves? I mean, in between the wars in Great Britain, you had that infamous Oxford Resolution in which people said they would not fight for king or country. And we had the same thing recently in America, a poll of people in the so-called baby boom generation. 40% said there was no cause for which they'd be willing to fight for their country. Of course not. Why should they? There's no cause greater than personal pleasure. Thirdly, biblical truth provides a sound guide for public policy. I am invited to speak to many of the political bodies in America. I've been invited to over half the state legislatures to speak, and I meet with a lot of public officials and with people in our Congress because the prison crisis is so grave and we are doing something in the prisons and they see what we're doing, and so I'm frequently invited to speak, and it's a wonderful experience. I had a time in one of our legislatures recently in Texas, which is one of our large states, where I was invited to come in and speak to the Texas legislature. I don't know, well, yes, I've seen the parliament in London in session, and the Texas legislature looks like that at some times, although people are yelling at each other and running around. I walked into the floor of the Texas legislature, and the Speaker of the House walked in with me, and I looked out, and here was some poor member of the legislature speaking on a bill and on legislation, and in the legislature, everybody milling around, talking to one another, had telephones beside their desk, no one paying a bit of attention to the fellow speaking. The gallery's absolutely packed with school children getting their civics lesson, and this total chaos. And the speaker said to me, now don't worry, Mr. Colson. He said, I'll hit the gavel, I'll try to get their attention, but don't feel badly, he said, if they don't pay any attention. He said, it's sort of a tradition here in this legislature that they don't listen to the speaker. He said, it was during the 1988 election, and he said George Bush was just here a couple of weeks ago, and while he spoke, no one paid any attention. He said, so just don't feel too badly. And I said, all right, I've spoken in prisons all over the world. I've spoken in football and baseball locker rooms, and I guess I can speak in the Texas legislature. So I started talking loud as I possibly could. And all of a sudden a few men came and sat down over here, and then a few more over here. Within 3 minutes, that entire legislature was listening. Now, gentlemen, ladies, it was not my oratorical skills. It was the fact that politicians in America at least have a growing interest in prisons, sometimes quite a personal interest. My favorite cartoon is the two convicts. We wear striped suits. There's the stereotype of a convict in America. Two convicts sitting next to each other in a cell, and one leans over to the other and said, "Food was better here when you were governor." Glad you laughed. The Texas legislature didn't. But that day I talked to them about what they had to do in Texas. They had 10,000 beds short. Can you imagine that? The entire prison population of Scotland is 4,000 prisoners. And does that mean that we've done 45 minutes? Good. All right. I'll be through within my prescribed time. 10,000 beds short. Imagine it. And they're out of money in the state. So I said, what you ought to do, and I gave a talk to them. I said, what you ought to do is take these nonviolent first offenders, which is about 50% of the prison population, and instead of keeping them in a cell, which costs $15,000 a year to maintain them, and here, by the way, it's £25,000 a year to maintain a person in prison, rather than having sitting in that cell doing nothing, if they're nonviolent, non-dangerous, get them out on the street where they can work and pay back their victim and do something useful with their lives. Tremendous response to that. As a matter of fact, subsequently the legislature has passed a restitution statute. But what was really interesting was that the legislators lined up afterwards to come in and see me after I finished speaking. I waited in a little room off the speaker's chambers, and the speaker brought them in, and there must have been 20 of them. And it was really marvelous. They would come in and they all said the same thing. Most of them said the same thing. They would say, "Mr. Colson, that's a marvelous idea, that restitution. Where did that come from?" I love it. I said, "Have you got a Bible?" "Don't let you. I got a Bible at home." I said, "You go home, you dust it off, you open up to Exodus 20, 21. You'll see that's exactly what God told Moses at Mount Sinai. You'll see that's exactly what Jesus taught Zacchaeus. That's the biblical way." Wonderful opportunity. Now, if I'd gone to them and said, "You must pass a restitution statute because Exodus 21, this is what God said," they'd all turn it off because they don't believe the Bible. But you argue biblical truth in society and begin to see then what a witness that becomes. And our job as Christians, I needn't tell the descendants of John Knox, our job of Christians is to bring Christian truth into the public arena, into every area, into education, arts, science, government, literature, everywhere. Let the glory of God shine forth. And that's what our secularized, valueless secular society so desperately needs. And fourthly, religious values, a religious value system, is the one protection against a tyrannical state. And Donald Blush, a theologian in America who writes some very, very provocative things, Donald Blush says that a secular society inevitably will become totalitarian. And the reason is that without that commitment to a higher authority, the state becomes its own god. The state fills the religious vacuum. And so it is the one place, and that's why tyrants for thousands of years have found the cross such an offense. Because the very fact that that cross stands is a challenge to their absolute authority. That's why Stalin, Hitler, all of the tyrants of the 20th century have first persecuted the Jew and the Christian, because the scandal is that he believes in a king above the kings of this earth. And it's that love of that king that caused the people in Poland to take to the streets. Solidarity was born in the church. In East Germany, it was in the meeting halls, the churches of the Lutheran Church of East Germany that the people began to meet and protest. They began to meet for the wrong reasons. They were protesting on political grounds, but then suddenly someone suggested they begin to sing some hymns. And then suddenly, I just talked with a journalist who just back from East Germany, where he was talking with people who said it was in the churches that they felt a call to a higher authority where they could challenge the rulers in their state. We know similar stories that have happened in Hungary, in Czechoslovakia, Romania, minister of the Reformed Church. All through Eastern Europe, people who believed there was a higher authority. And one story which I tell in Kingdoms in Conflict, and I won't tonight, but Bonino Aquino became a great friend of mine when he was in America because it was my book, Born Again, that drove him to his knees in a Philippine prison cell, and he gave his life to Christ inside that cell, surrendered his life to Christ. And Aquino, when he went back to the Philippines, he called me in 1983, in August of 1983, just as he was getting on a plane to leave, and he said, he was going back, and I said, Ninoy, are you sure you want to? He said, of course. He said, there's no reason not to. He said, I'm all right. I said, they might throw you in prison. He said, if Marcos throws me in prison, I will start prison fellowship. He said, if he allows free elections, I'll be elected president. And he said, if he has me killed, I'll be with Jesus. Because he was killed, but you see, you couldn't stop what he stood for. Great evangelical fervor swept through the Philippines. 1.5 million people in Bible studies. And then both Protestants and Catholics out in the streets and the tanks couldn't move. And democracy was restored. You see, that's the one source of strength, and that's why the ultimate danger of the secular society is that it leads to tyranny. Only our neighbors who won't come into our churches could understand why it is so vital that there be a healthy Christian influence in society. Not imposed from the top down, but lived out by Christian people. We have an apologetic, we have a job to do to sell our neighbors on the vital importance to society of this healthy Christian influence being lived in. Those are my three propositions. What does that say to us as a church? Very quickly, three things, it seems to me. One is that the church must be concerned with the value system of the society around it. Not enough brothers to be great preachers, as I know all of you are. Not enough to have church growth. Not enough to bring people into the church and feel good. But the body of believers have to be concerned with the society and the culture around them. No more than that would need to be said in this land where the Scottish Reformation had its greatest impact on society, where the Reformation had its greatest impact on society of anywhere. The mind of society has to be seized. And see, you're in a marvelous position to do this. Jacques Ellul writes that the French critic, historian, lawyer, philosopher, writes that the job of the pastor is to convey theological truth to the lay people so that the lay people can assimilate it and then live it out in the world. And the problem is that the Holy Spirit gets short-circuited when it stops in the church. The job of conveying that theological truth is so that it can be assimilated by lay people, that they go out then and minister and live their faith in the world. Second, we need in everything we do to think Christianly. I get up in the morning and I read the Bible and I read the local newspaper, so I get a measure of what's right and what's wrong, to measure current events against Christian truth. Harry Belmeyer wrote that wonderful book titled The Christian Mind, and the first paragraph of which is, there is no longer a Christian mind. His argument was that we simply think Christianly about Christian issues and then fail to think Christianly about all other issues. And to those of us in the Reformed tradition, that should be a scandal. And third, we need to live out the gospel so that the world can see it. We talked about this last night when some of you were talking about some of the struggles you have in your churches, and I was thinking, if you could somehow let people see the reality of the gospel lived out in your communities, they'd be drawn to you. I've found that to be true so often, even in churches that are stagnant and where there's no growth and where the area may be changing. Nonetheless, when people see the love of God lived out, be what Edmund Burke called the little platoons of society. He said the big things happen in society not because people dictate it from the top down, but because Christian people live it out as part of the little platoons of society. Those three ways, it seems to me, the church is the primary instrument for the moral re-education of a society that is today in Western civilization, heading, I believe, for a new dark ages because it's extinguishing the light. It's secularizing. And if our neighbors really understood what the Christian truth meant lived out in society, they would welcome it. And it's our job to make that apologetic, both in word and in deed.
The first point is that we're living in a secularized society which is rejecting all forms of religion. As a conference recently, which suggested that that's not the case. That, in fact, the Christian religion is being replaced with other religions like Eastern ones, New Age, and so on.
Oh, well, man is irresistibly religious. Man is going to find his own religion. He's going to be, as Pascal said, his own God. And yes, there will be other religions which take its place. When Howard was talking this morning about the New Age movement, 25% of all Americans believe in reincarnation. The New Age has probably affected a quarter of our churches. That's probably a pretty fair guess. When true religion is rejected, counterfeit religion takes its place, or the state becomes its own God, or man becomes his own God. But we are irresistibly religious in that sense. But I think when I say secularized, that's a good correction you've made. I really am talking about a rejection of Orthodox Christianity and the Judeo-Christian tradition. They wouldn't call it, that's right. They would not call it religious because the religious has the wrong connotation to it. They would call it finding themselves. Horrible phrase. I can find myself. Woman left her husband of 20 years of marriage, 3 children recently in New York City, and left and went to Hawaii. Nothing wrong with her taste, at least, in places to go, to make chocolates, and left her family, she said, quote, to find myself. Epidemic.
The term you're using, secularization, seems to me that it is actually the secularization of professing Christians and the Christian church, which in fact allows movements like the New Age movement and
well, Donald Blush, whom I quoted a few moments ago, has a very trenchant phrase in one of his books in which he said, secularism advances only as orthodoxy retreats. I write a column regularly for a magazine called Christianity Today in America, and I'm periodically critical of the church for failing to preach a convicting message of sin and the need for repentance and the need for fruits of the Spirit among people who profess Christ. and holding people to spiritual accountability, because what happens when you don't do that, you're simply trying to fill up the pews on Sunday with people, warm bodies, but you're losing the authority of the church. And it no longer stands for absolute truth. And when it doesn't, then why not go down the street where they make you feel even better? I mean, the awful part of the Jim Baker scandal, which you read about in America, was not really, I mean, the most, one day we'll all be in judgment of God, and we should never judge each other, but I kind of suspect that when Jim Baker has to face his judgment, it won't be so much that he stole money from the ministry, or that he had a sexual indiscretion, so much as he preached a false gospel. That God would give you anything you wanted. All you had to do was ask.
Yes. I don't think you should yield on the word secular, because although there are those religions and
people, they're counterfeit religions.
I think if you take the total population, I think they would be relatively small compared with those who are utterly secular today in our land.
And you're talking here?
Yes, yes, yes.
I think Americans would probably consider themselves both religious and secular.
Yes.
They would think that it's fine to be tolerant and accept anybody's point of view, and they really are religion, because they're like one of the people that Robert Bella found in his survey, a woman named Sheila. She said that I've never gone to church, and I don't feel that I need to. I really have a deep faith. I call it, it's a little voice that I hear inside of me. I call it Sheilaism. And it really captures what people think. I mean, they can know God themselves in their own way.
You're saying that Leipzig has an experience of revivalism, an experience of religion, which we don't have to the same degree here. You commented that one of the dangers in the church as well, perhaps, is that people wanting to feel good. From your perspective as an American, commenting on your side and this side of the Atlantic, to what degree do you feel that a modern emphasis on the experience in religion, the experience in Christianity, is deleterious to saltiness in bridging into society as a whole? Would that be an observation you want to make?
Are you distinguishing people who have an experience and then do nothing else from the saltiness, meaning that we're to be the salt that live it out in society? I'm not sure I understood you.
I'm thinking of the dominance of, say, charismatic Pentecostalism. I'm thinking of revivalism, whereby there is an emphasis that a person feels good, and you are criticizing the sort of religion that goes no further than that. Do you feel the emphasis that we've seen on experience detracts from effective discipleship?
Yes. When I was converted, when 17 years ago this summer, in the driveway of a friend's home just outside of Boston, when I heard the gospel for the first time, I was 41 years old, and I'd never heard the gospel. Or if I'd heard it, I didn't have ears with which to hear. When I heard it the first time, and I surrendered that night, sitting in my automobile in a flood of tears, I couldn't drive out of the driveway of my friend's home because I was crying to her. I didn't know anything about regeneration or what the word evangelical meant. I knew nothing. I just knew that if this Jesus was real, I wanted to know him. And if my Christian life had stopped there, I probably could go around and give wonderful, glowing testimonies, but I think I would be long gone from the Christian faith. What happened to me instead was that a group of men got a hold of me and started to meet with me and hold me to account, challenge some of the things I was saying and doing, teaching me, giving me wonderful books to read, taking me through the scriptures week after week through a navigator's courses, and helping to disciple me in Christ, so that I realized that my faith was not just an emotional experience, my faith was real. And I'm afraid we don't do that enough with people. And that's probably part of the problem with, I mean, maybe if I hadn't been the closest advisor to the President of the United States, people wouldn't have done it with me either. Maybe it was because I was a celebrity that they grabbed me and got a hold of me. But we don't do anywhere near enough of that in the church. We lose people who come in just to have an experience, and we think that's all there is to it. And we don't teach people that there is more to the Christian faith than simply that momentary emotion. And then we keep building on emotion, which is a dreadful thing. Now, emotion is fine. I find myself weeping sometimes when I preach. And I'm a guy that used to be a very tough individual, as Jim Packer put it. I was. I mean, I was probably all those things and then some. Marine Corps infantry captain. I would never cry in my life. I find myself preaching sometimes crying when I preach, or thinking about things God has done in my life, and I find myself weeping in gratitude to God for the very thought that Jesus Christ would die for my sins. 17 years later, I still find myself overwhelmed by that. So there's nothing wrong with emotion, but just you can't base your whole faith on emotion. You've got to base your faith on the objective truth of the gospel, which I believe is historically validated. That's why I asked that question this morning. I believe that you can historically validate the truth of the Christian faith. The resurrection is historically validated, so is Scripture. The word. Yes?
The statistics tell us that there's a huge proportion of the population of the United States profess to be born again. And I come from Northern Ireland. We have the same thing there. A huge proportion of the population say that they're born again. And yet, both our societies have enormous problems. Now, you've been touching on some of these things, but I wonder if you could perhaps say, to touch on some areas where the church is manifestly failing with all the statistical advantages she has, and yet is making such scant impact upon the society in which she's found in both those places. And I'm sure there are other examples as well.
Well, this poll showed that 70 million Americans claim that they are born again. I believe that fully half of them do not know what the term means. And another very significant percentage believe they are born again, but aren't. And that the number of people who really have made a commitment of their life to Christ is no more than probably 15% of the American people. So I think the polls, and I've talked to George Gallup about this, who, by the way, is a very fine Christian layman who loves the Lord and does the most prominent polling in America. And George Gallup agrees with me that, as he put it, our religion is a mile wide and an inch deep. It has no real roots. And people go to church in many communities because it's the thing to do, and but they haven't carried Calvin has a great phrase in the Institutes about taking your knowledge and letting it work in your heart. They haven't let their knowledge work in their heart so that their lives are changed. Plus, there is tremendous hostility towards the Christian faith in America today. Tremendous hostility. And so the average person is reluctant. He may share his faith privately, one-on-one with other people, but he is reluctant to argue Christian truth with his secular neighbors. And so we really don't have much impact on things. I mean, I can tell you case after case of Christians in public office who back away from what they believe and know to be true because if they're labeled a fundamentalist, they'd be driven out of office, and they would be. So there's a real hostility in America. All this surface business about everybody being born again is one thing, But in terms of its impact upon the culture, that's something altogether different. We're not impacting the culture. And I suspect in Northern Ireland, I've been there many times, that you've been inoculated so many times, you know all the right words, but when it comes to living it out, there's a bigger problem to live with. And so that bigger problem takes precedence over what you ought to know in your heart to be true. Is that not fair?
Comment on the prevalence of, say, right-wing evangelicalism linked to sectarianism.
I was one of the... It was interesting last night when the question was raised about Christians in politics. I was one of those in America, probably the first evangelical to openly criticize the Moral Majority, which was a political movement that sort of wrapped the flag around the gospel and was attempting to do very good things. I mean, right to life, to stop abortions, to ban pornography, to bring back moral values in American life, but was doing it in a very confused way in which we were, in which the argument was being made sort of embracing one particular political agenda and looking for political solutions. And that can become idolatrous. If you really believe that you can solve the country's moral dilemma by just electing people to office, you're engaging in idolatry. You're also falling, succumbing to the political illusion. And so I criticize that, all the while personally agreeing 100% with its agenda. I mean, I believed that what it was trying to accomplish was right, the way it was doing it was dead wrong. I believe that Christians belong in politics because we ought to be instruments of righteousness and justice, and therefore we should bring our Christian faith to work in the political arena, and we should be seeking to be righteous, but not turning it into a political party or embracing one political party or marrying one particular ideology. The beauty of the Christian is that he can stand back and be critical of anyone's ideology. And we do not believe in an ideology. We believe in the risen Christ and the righteousness of God. And the word in Scripture in the Old Testament, which if you use the King James is judgment, and the word if you use the New International Version or the more modern translations is justice, is used repeatedly throughout the Scripture. But it's not justice as we think about it in man's terms. That's a perversion. I listen to Christians argue over that all the time, and they miss it terribly. They either adopt the liberal secular definition. They first of all adopt a secular definition. Justice is everybody getting his due. And then they either take the liberal definition, which is society ought to provide for everybody to have an equal share of wealth. That's what getting their due means. And so the liberal evangelical and liberal Christian and the mainline churches have believed that God's justice means everybody getting an equal share of wealth. The conservative is just as wrong. He thinks everybody getting his due means punish the wrongdoer. And so within the Christian church and within evangelicalism, there is this dichotomy over the word justice, and both sides are mistranslating that word. If you go to the Hebrew, you will see that that word literally translated is righteousness. What God looks for in society is righteousness. And in the Septuagint, you will see that the Greek translation for the word justice commonly throughout the Old Testament is the same word in Greek that is used for justification. And it was Luther's discovery of that that led to his conversion. Luther said, I used to tremble and quake and because I never could measure up to the justice of God, and I feared the wrath of God, this God I could never understand, until one day I realized that the justice of God was that of which the apostle wrote when he said that I will be made just by my faith. Justification by faith. It's the same word. And that's the word. That's what the Christian politician ought to be doing. Be an instrument of righteousness. Making men righteous. Just societies become just when people become just. Just societies are just or righteous in God's sight when they reflect the righteousness of God in the structures of society. Far beyond the way we normally think of that term. And that's what Christian politicians ought to be aiming for. And that's what Wilberforce did. Which is why he's one of the outstanding examples to me of a Christian politician.
Thank you. I'm very grateful to you for a number of things that you've said. I wonder whether I could push a little further in your thoughts about the future. I mean, I haven't read the latest book. But I certainly would go along with this notion of a new knight coming to Western society. It seems to me that chickens are coming home to roost from 400 years ago. In different ways, and finally in our generation it seems to me that the sun is setting on Western culture. Now, I wonder from your own experience and with your own blend of concern for orthodoxy and concern for Christian engagement in the world, what kind of state you think the church is in that you get to go into the night?
Good question.
Whether you think there are encouraging signs that the evangelical renewal in your country, in our country, and over much of the world in which evangelicalism has for so long eclipsed, whether this is creating a church which is in some state to do God's work as an outpost.
That's a hard question. And if I give you too honest an answer, I'll send you away too discouraged. What did Sinclair say yesterday? Make people feel positive. And maybe it's just I'm getting along in years, but I don't see the forces at work that would reverse the very powerful forces of secularism that have seized the mind of Western civilization. You cannot find it in any academic campus, on any academic campus in the United States. In a handful of Christian campuses, will you find people who will defend truth? That's not an overstatement. That's true. I don't know what the case is here in Great Britain. I've talked to people who have told me that it isn't much better here, although there are some outposts.
But there are other parts of the world.
But there are other parts of the world.
What about Korea?
Oh, my. You see the most marvelous revival taking place in Korea. Phenomenal. Small percentage of the people. When I was there, it was 5 million. I understand from our Korean brother today that there now may be 12 million Christians in the country and 40 million people. And yet they have the most profound influence in the country. On the other hand, you go to Singapore, as I was just a little while ago, and I met with the Minister of Education, who's a Christian, his name is Tan, and he brought all the Christian members of Parliament, and here's a country in which 50% of the people engage in ancestor worship, 20% of the people are Muslims, and they're surrounded by Indonesia and Malaysia, Muslim countries, and they depend on their water from their neighbors, and so they're very, very careful not to offend the Muslims, very, very careful not to offend the predominant religious framework of the country, and the Christians are like 10% of the country. And Minister Tan said to me, he said, it's been kind of a mixed thing here in Singapore because of our commerce with Britain and the United States. We have adopted English as the language, the official language in the schools. But he said, what has happened now with all of our young people taking and speaking English and reading English is that we're getting your magazines and videotapes from the United States, and it's polluting the minds of our people, and it makes it incredibly difficult for me as a Christian to stand up as Minister of Education and defend the fact that I'm a Christian. He said, when all the families are going home teaching their children Mandarin at night so that they don't have to be polluted by what you're sending from the West. And so I wonder if we don't, with our enormous economic power in the West, look at the first exports to East Germany. Did you read about the first exports? Playboy magazine, West German edition, the first export. And the editor of Penthouse had bragged that he could get Penthouse into Hungary by January, and he will. They'll be getting Penthouse and Playboy much faster than they'll be getting Bibles. So I guess I'm a pessimist. I don't see... I've been all around the world. I see in Korea revival. I see the church having a profound influence in Eastern Europe. I have recently been with a Soviet dissident, a Russian dissident, who is quite a remarkable lady. Her name is Irina Radishinskaya. And she makes the extraordinary statement that there are more Christians than communists in the Soviet Union today, after 70 years of official atheism, and that's got to be one of the miracles of the 20th century. And she thinks there'll be a great revival of the church in Russia as soon as the communists are overthrown, which she predicts will happen within a year. And she, 6 months ago, predicted everything that has happened in the past 6 months. So she's got pretty good insights, I guess. Maybe Solzhenitsyn was right. Maybe there'll be a great spiritual awakening in the East. But I really don't see evidences of it in the West. I've been through South America. I've been to all the countries where people get very, very excited about the evangelical awakening in some countries. And I've seen it, and it's wonderful. I've seen it in Africa. But if you're talking about the domination of culture in the world, it's got to come from the West or from Soviet Union and East Europe, basically. I would say this, that one thing Christians ought never to be, and I end up my book Against the Night this way, is historical determinists. We must never be historical determinists. Marxists are historical determinists. Christians believe that God in his sovereignty always has history in his hands, and so he can rewrite and change and shape the course of history, and often does it through the most unlikely people in the most unlikely places. I mean, the last great revival in this last great revival in modern times began, did it not, in 1904 in Wales, in the back of a church. Someone stood up and said, I'm born again. Spread all through the English-speaking world. Put the judges out of business. Cleared the court calendars. Put the police out. Closed the taverns. I mean, this can happen at any time. My own belief is that the church ought to do two things today. And this is what I basically argue as hard as I know how to argue. One is to be the church, as Luther put it, live our faith, preach the gospel, stand on orthodoxy, call people to repentance. Be the church, be as aggressive as we can, think Christianly, behave in society with the little platoons, living out the gospel in society. But at the same time, realize in our own minds that we may well be within a generation of another dark age. And if you remember when the barbarians and Goths, Vandals, took over Europe, what was left were the little monastic outposts. The monastic outposts did not only preserve the Bible, they preserved learning, they drained the swamps, they taught medicine, they kept civilization alive, and that we may well be in that position.
Well then, what are we going to do then, and what are we going to look for in the future?
Well, I hope right here we're going to
You just said it.
Sing the praises to God the way Scotsmen sing them, and go on and do our job,
because
do our duty.
A good deal of that is pretty daunting. I won't say discouraging, very daunting. But just exactly what Nigel has in mind, what I've in mind. How are we to be encouraged? We know what we have to do, and we've got to go on doing it. I think we've got to do it a lot better. You were suggesting, America, that a lot of people don't speak the gospel and live the gospel because they lack courage. That would be truer of Britain here. You know that it is reckoned that Britain is perhaps the most secular country in Europe.
I've heard that, sir.
Something has happened here, particularly Presbyterians, although we're not all Presbyterians, that the evangelical Presbyterianism has almost died out in New Zealand, Wales, where else? England. But there's been a resurgence in Scotland.
Right.
Well, ought we to have any hope of that? All these
gems?
These are half of the number who I believe would be preaching the gospel and standing by the word.
I would be greatly encouraged, but I wouldn't be out doing what I'm doing if I really believed that there was no hope. But also, every morning when I get up, I say, Lord, help me today to do my duty no matter what. Because I'm called to preach the gospel, to live my faith, and to do it no matter what happens. Let me close with one little story. We go into prisons all the time. And I spend time in hundreds of prisons around the world. We got permission to go into one of the toughest prisons in America about a year and a half ago, called San Quentin. We hadn't been allowed in there before. And the prison holds about 2,300 people, maximum security, death row, the toughest prisoners in the California state system. You probably have heard of San Quentin. 130, 40 years old, sits on a big cliff looking over San Francisco Harbor, a very forbidding place, dangerous place. We've been trying to get in there for years, and the prison governor, the prison warden, would not allow us in because of security, and finally he called and said, you can go in. Well, I thought about that in human terms, the way you would think about starting a ministry. I thought, we're going to have a great rally. Jim Jewell, who's with me, went out to California, walked the cell blocks, made arrangements to go into the prison chapel. It was wonderful. And got 350 inmates signed up to come out from the maximum security prison. The chapel seats 500. We had 50 coming from the prison farm. I had 50 volunteers with me. I got a great black gospel singer from Minnesota, Tom Tipton, who sings on television a lot, to come with me. And we were going to turn it into a huge crusade. We're really going to start the ministry in San Quentin in a big way. We're going to get to 500 people. Got to the prison that night of the rally, and the warden came out. We call him wardens, runs the prison, and said, sorry, Mr. Colson, prison's locked down. We discovered 2 days ago a cache of weapons, and every inmate is locked in his cell. I was crestfallen. It would work so long to get in this prison. This was going to be our great beginning of the ministry. And he said, if you want to go ahead and have your rally anyway in the chapel, go right ahead. Well, I had 50 people with me, volunteers on the outside, and he said, I'll bring the 50 inmates up from the prison farm. That'd be 100. And you brothers know what it's like when you're in a hall that seats 500 and there are 100 people. I mean, all you see are the 400 empty seats. Plus, they were all the converted. I mean, the ones from the prison farm were all Christians, the volunteers were all Christians. So I sat there thinking to myself, no way am I going to get up there and preach an evangelistic message tonight. Ridiculous. I have a message I preach in prisons all over the world about the two crosses on the two thieves on the crosses next to Jesus, and the first thief and the second thief. And the people can, the men and women in prison can really identify with the Christ of the Scriptures. But I decided this time I'm not going to do it. And when I got up to speak, I looked in the back of the room and there was a television camera. And I thought to myself, I wonder if the chaplain is recording this for
use of Machapa. Maybe he is. And if he is, I guess I'd better give the whole 30-minute message. And so I preached the entire time right at that camera. First time in my life, I didn't look at the 400 empty seats. First time in my life I ever tried to evangelize a camera. And when I got through, I sat down, and it turned out to be a pretty good evening. I mean, it was kind of fun. I walking out with a chaplain, I said, what a shame those 350 guys couldn't be here to hear that message. And the chaplain said to me, well, didn't they tell you? I said, tell me what? And he said, didn't the governor tell you, the warden tell you? This, because he locked the prison down, he arranged to have this service tonight telecast throughout the prison. The entire 2,300 inmates have been watching. Not only were they watching, it was shown again at 8 o'clock the next morning, it was shown again at 4 o'clock the next afternoon, it was shown, we were told, 12 times thereafter, with all kinds of men ending up giving their lives to Christ inside their prison. Now, if Chuck Colson did it his way, he'd have gotten a great rally with 350 inmates. Those doors were closed, God had his way, and his power moved all through that prison. So we're never defeated. Where's my book again? Let me see Against the Night. I'm going to read you in closing one little poem. Chesterton wrote a ballad about King Alfred of England. The men of the East may spell the stars and times and triumphs mark, but the men signed of the cross of Christ go gaily in the dark.